in this new piece that you, together with other friends of this show, wrote on the consortium news, you're talking about the possibility of a third world war. Why do you see the necessity of this topic right now? And why do you see it so relevant right now with the situation that we're having?
Well, unfortunately, it is terribly relevant as we see it. A little bit of background here. Our group, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, set up shop, so to speak, in January of 2003. Email was sort of new in those days, but we were using email mostly because we were spread out all over the country to stay in touch with one another. And we saw that not only was Cheney and Bush, were they not only preparing to make an unnecessary war against Iraq, but sadly, our former colleagues were manufacturing evidence to justify it. Now, in intelligence work, intelligence analysis work, you can't get any worse than that. So, before we would put an op-ed in whatever newspaper would take it, not major newspapers, usually Christian Science Monitor, on occasion, other second-tier newspapers, we would feel a little odd saying, as I did, Dick Cheney is lying through his teeth, and so are our former colleagues. So what you want to do is you want to compare notes, right? So you're not sitting next to your colleague, but you are on email with him. So you say, Fred, I think Cheney's lying through his teeth. What do you think? I'm sure he is. So move forward. So that was a sanity check, right? And that's really where we decided to call ourselves VIPS, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And not only that, at the time in Washington, remember, January 2003, just 2.5 months before the war, there wasn't much sanity in Washington and nobody was willing to tell the truth, not even our former colleague. That's what our job was, to tell the truth, and they were not doing it. So our first memo was written on February 5th. And the reason I remember that is, of course, is because Colin Powell made that meretricious speech there before the UN, reiterating all kinds of falsehoods to, again, justify the war. The next day, the Washington Post, the New York Times, all the mainstream media said, now we got to go get Iraq, you know. Powell is the honest guy. He has great respect, and he's laid it all out there. We got to go attack Iraq, except us, right? We agreed when we heard he was going to make a speech that we would watch it. And that we would write on it like we used to when Brezhnev or Mao Zedong made a speech, you know. We used to have to watch it if we could and then write it up before the Washington Post, the New York Times gave their story to the White House. And if we didn't beat them, they wouldn't even read it. Well, chances are they would go with the mainstream media. So that afternoon, by 5 o'clock, we got this memo out on AFP, Agence France-Presse, the French national media. And that was the only one that put it out, but it got out there. Okay, what did we say? We said that whatever Powell adduced there, it certainly was not sufficient to begin a war, okay? And that there were all kinds of holes in his argumentation. And we finished up with this paragraph, which I have committed to memory because it's so relevant these days. We said, Mr. Bush, this is George W. Bush, Mr. President, we strongly advise you to expand, to widen the circle of your advisors beyond those clearly bent on an unnecessary war, from a necessary war, which is completely unnecessary, and from which the unintended consequences are likely to be catastrophic, period, end quote. Now, we take no joy or no pride even in calling that one for what it was. But there we were, right on the record. We were ridiculed? Of course we were, to the degree they couldn't suppress us because it was out on the AFP wire, okay? Well, that began our tenure as commentators on the dishonest approach, not only of the administration, but painfully of our former colleagues. We had two more memos before the invasion, warning the president. We had to assume that he was unaware that Cheney was fixing all this stuff. And so we talked about lies, miscalculations, all this kind of stuff. We chapter and verse, and of course, the war began anyway. We didn't stop, okay? Nevertheless, we persisted, one might say. And after, what, how many years now? Wow, 21 years, okay? We've just issued our latest issuance. And this one is the one you referred to. It's addressed at the key question in the United States right now. What about Ukraine? I mean, is it worth throwing good money after bad? I mean, $100 billion isn't enough to, I mean, what's going on here? Now, we did this memorandum this week on the first anniversary of when we did last year, January 26, 2023, okay? And in that memo, we talked about the bad intelligence once again. That's, you know, that's where we come into the picture. We know what bad intelligence looks like, right? So we told the president, look, you're getting really bad intelligence. A year ago, we said, look, you've just been told by the Director of National Intelligence that the Russians are very ill prepared for the offensive that the Ukrainians are going to mount in spring. Okay, turn out to be summer, okay? And that the Russians are running out of ammunition. And they have no indigenous capability to produce those weapons. So we're very optimistic about this coming offensive by the Ukrainians. Now, at this same time, January 2023, the president had just approved sending Abrams tanks, mind you, Abrams tanks into the battle into Ukraine. And everybody was saying, whoa, this may turn the tide. So we thought he needed to be corrected on that. So let me see what we if I can find out. Yeah, here it is. We said, and I quote, none of the newly promised weaponry will stop Russia from defeating what's left of the Ukrainian army. If you have been told otherwise, Mr. President, replace your intelligence and military advisors with competent professionals. The sooner, the better, period, end quote. January 26, 2023, okay? So this most recent one is an update. We had to use the same subtitle. The title, as I said, is Throwing Good Money After Bad. The subtitle is Decisions in an Intelligence Vacuum. The same subtitle this year as last year. And what we did was we just pointed out that the head of national intelligence had said that last year. And then we said now in July, actually on July 13th last year, Mr. President, you said that the Russians had already lost the war. Now, we don't know where you got that. You didn't get that from us, that's for sure. Maybe you got that from the head of the CIA, who the week before had put it this way. Putin's war has already been a strategic failure for Russia. Its military weaknesses laid bare, period. End quote. This is not some idle comment. This was an op-ed that William Burns wrote in the Washington Post. So taking his cue from that, perhaps the president gets up and he says in Helsinki, okay, Putin has already lost this war. That's a direct quote. Now, more recently, they're not saying that anymore. They're not saying we were wrong, but they say now it's a stalemate. It's a stalemate. No, neither side is going to win. They say, it's just a stalemate. Well, that's what the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, who is really the receipt of all this intelligence information for what it's worth, that's what he says. Well, you know, we tell the president this year, that's also wrong. It's not Russia that's losing the war in Ukraine. It's Ukraine and the NATO supporters. So getting to your question now, how does Biden and Sullivan and Nolan and Blinken, these four blind mice, as somebody called them, what do they do now? Okay. The war is going very badly. The Russians are, they call it attriting, right? Attrition, attrit, 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 attrit. And the latest movements have shown that the Russians could go all the way to the Dnieper River, well, I would say in a month or two. Will they do that? I don't know. I don't think so. I think the Russians are trying to impress upon the United States that, look, we're ready to deal, but we're ready to deal on the realities on the ground. We don't want a Ukraine and NATO, and it's the same old story. Let's talk this time, because you had a deal back in March, April of 2022. You reneged on that deal. Well, how about now, after a half million Ukrainian soldiers are dead? I think that's what the deal now is. And so we're saying to the president, look, this is the reality, not what you've been told by people like Austin or Bill Burns or Avril Haines. They were wrong then. They're probably wrong now. Maybe I want to listen to us this time, okay? Now, what's the reality here? Maybe I'll just add what else we say, because I found it really interesting. You know, I've been around a while. Vietnam was my crucible. And there have been historians that have written about the kind of mindset. I will say this first, that there is a mindset that these little people, these barefoot pattering people in the jungles of Vietnam, are no match for us. Afghanistan, after Vietnam, I asked Matthew Ho, who was a very high level senior official at the embassy in Kabul, I said, was there a tinge of racism in the approach of the generals there to Afghanistan? He looked at me and he said, Ray, they kept saying, the United States is not going to lose to those people. Okay. So there's a tinge of superiority, exceptionalism, indispensability to the U.S. outlook here. And that's a big mistake. And so we went back and we looked at some of the historians. One of our favorite historians is Barbara Tuchman, who wrote an incredible book called The March of Folly, from Troy, remember Troy? Troy War, okay, to Vietnam. And this is what she said. We quoted in this memo to the president. She talks about wooden-headedness. Wooden-headedness, and this is a quote, consists in assessing a situation in terms of preconceived, fixed notions and ignoring or rejecting contrary signs. It is acting according to the wish and not allowing yourself to be deflected by facts. Now, she gave an example in her book, Philip II of Spain. I had to read up on him because I didn't remember who he was, but it was a big deal in those days, right? She says, look, in the 16th century, Philip II of Spain is a good example. His policies kept failing. Think Vietnam, think Afghanistan, think Ukraine. Philip II, 16th century, what's that, five, 6 centuries ago? His policies kept failing. But no experience of failure, says Tuchman, could shake his belief in the essential excellence of his policy. That's wooden-headedness, okay? In the end, she says, he amassed too much power and got involved in too many wars and spent too much of the Spanish wealth, and the Spain declined in power. That was the beginning of it. Now, we thought that might become clear to, if not Biden, then his advisors, you know. Is there an analogy here? I mean, do you have to go back 5 centuries? Well, it turns out we don't. And the next thing we cite is a more recent statement by Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, who, coming out of his illness, supervises this virtual meeting of all these defense people in the NATO alliance that are going to help Ukraine. And he says, you know, we can't really fund them anymore because of this Congress. But you're going to have to start digging deeper and deeper. And that brought to mind the more colloquial quip that says, you know, if you're in a hole, stop digging, okay? So we finished up, and this goes directly to your point, by reminding the president of what we said exactly a year ago. And that was, I want to read this because it speaks to the strategic situation here in a way that my own words would not. People say that Putin is paranoid, right? He sees, you know, what we're trying to get him. He's paranoid, okay? Well, that charge does not pass the smell test, we say here. Because he's heard from Secretary of Defense Austin himself, quote, one of U.S. goals in Ukraine is to see a weakened Russia. Get this. The U.S. is ready to move heaven and earth to help Ukraine win this war against Russia, period, end quote. Okay, so Putin is paranoid. That's the defense secretary in Washington, okay? So we repeated our warning from the year before, saying, well, you know, can the U.S. achieve what Austin wants? And the answer is no, not without using nuclear weapons. And then we remind the president, you know, you said you didn't want World War III. Well, nuclear weapons, however small, are not going to be able to avoid World War III. Our last two sentences. Thus, and maybe you have to listen carefully to this because it's a little convoluted, but it's how we reason to this. There is a large conceptual and exceptionally dangerous disconnect here. Simply stated, it is not possible to, quote, win the war against Russia, end quote, and avoid World War III. Got that? You can't have both, okay? So our final quip here, that Defense Secretary Austin may think that this is possible, is downright scary. In any case, the Kremlin has to assume that he thinks so, and not only he. So there comes in the nuclear. But that's why our editor gave it that title about nuclear, you know, avoiding World War III. I guess enough said on that, except there's no indication that Biden realizes this. And, you know, will Blinken and Sullivan say, well, Mr. President, remember what we told you last year? Yeah. Will Abel Haynes say, well, you know, we had such optimism about that counteroffensive by Ukraine, but it's not the Russians that ran out of ammunition. And they do, and they are producing what they need. We got that wrong. It was the West that's run out of ammunition. We don't have any more, and we can't produce anymore. So we got that 180 degrees wrong. So what are we going to do now? Well, I'll just finish with this, and I think I've mentioned this before. My own take on this is that they can't lose in Ukraine. Because if they lose in Ukraine, it's likely they'll lose the presidential election in November. And if they lose the election to that other guy is a pretty vengeful fellow, and he is a good bit to be vengeful about. These guys, these clowns, including the president himself, could end up in jail or at least in the dock trying to defend themselves. So there's a personal stake in all this. So what'll they do? Will they say, oh, darn, that's not working out the way we want? Or will they do something sensible, like talk to the Russians? Sure, it's going to be at a disadvantage now. They had a good deal going back in March, April of 2022. Now it's going to be a tougher decision. Or will they say, well, we're running out of ammunition, except we have these mini nukes. Yeah, why don't we do that? Why don't we use just one of these mini? Yeah, they're small. They're just about one-tenth the size of Hiroshima. We'll show them put Russia's weenie business. And then we continue this war, well, at least until after the election. Then we have a better chance, you know, to win this election. So, again, that really disturbed me greatly because, as you can tell from the color of my hair, I've been around a really long time, but I've never been so concerned that the leadership in our country is feeling so vulnerable and so politically in danger that they may resort to this kind of thing as a last resort and do us all in.
The day after 25 Republican governors signed a joint statement in support of Texas, the Biden administration, under the pretext of climate protection, put on hold all LNG projects that just happened to be located mostly in Texas. This battle between Republicans and the Biden administration would mean some sort of sanctions on Europeans because the cost of energy is going to go up. Dependence of the EU on the US natural gas would benefit Europe in the long term or would hurt Europe?
Well, the parties that are helped by this, of course, are the Texas people who own and run the oil and natural gas stuff. It's a complicated complex here, but it's very clear that, as Secretary Blinken said a week after they exploded those pipelines, this is a strategic opportunity that we never really expected. It's such a strategic boom because now we'll be able to have economic progress here. We will have economic advantage and we'll be able to supply some. He said that, for God's sake. And of course, before the pipeline was blown, the president and Secretary of State Nuland, Under Secretary of State Nuland, said pretty much, well, you know, if the Russians invade Ukraine, we're going to, that pipeline will no longer exist. Okay. So, you know, there's one other aspect of this that most people don't know, and that is that the Europeans have been thrashing around for alternative ways to get their gas. Now, one thing that befuddles me is that one part of those four pipelines under the Baltic apparently was not damaged. And way back when, the Russians said, well, you know, we could sell for that one. And for some reason unknown to me, that didn't work out for some reason, okay? So they're threshing around, and all of a sudden, very lucrative gas fields are found offshore. Offshore of where? Offshore of Gaza. Oh, wow. So in whose waters? Well, Gaza is occupied territory under international law. Israel would claim those gas fields. As a matter of fact, Israel is negotiating with Greece and Cyprus and others to exploit those gas fields and make a bunch of money and allow the Europeans to have pipelines other than the ones that were destroyed. That's part of the Gaza thing too, okay? The Israelis are not going to give up Gaza unless they're really pressured to do so. So this economic thing is little known to the West because it's not in the mainstream press. And so the guys in Texas are also watching this, but don't see any immediate threat from it, at least pending the outcome of what happens. So the guys in Texas are making hand over fist money. The Europeans are paying the price. And the hard-to-believe aspect for me is that the Europeans throw up their hands and say, oh, well, if the Russians are going to invade us, we have to depend on the U.S. So no matter what the U.S. does to us, I mean, I could understand that right after World War II. I could understand that right after the Soviet Union fell apart, you know, that there had to be still dependence on the United States. But given all the stress and travail that U.S. actions have brought to West European, it boggles my mind still that, for example, the Germans in particular are unable to act like adults, unable to stand on their own 2 feet and say, no, we're going to do what's best for our national interests, not kowtow to you. And besides, you know, the Russians are much closer to us. They aren't to you.
We are having the 81st anniversary of Leningrad, and Putin was talking with Russians about this battle and the importance of this battle for Russians and what would it mean for their future and their ongoing battle against Nazis. When he's talking this way, in your opinion, how he sees the world right now, how do you find his statement?
I find them very poignant. People don't generally know that Putin grew up in Leningrad, that both his parents, his mother and his father, were survivors of the longest siege of that kind. Almost 1,000 days, I think it was 996 days, something like that, the Nazi siege of Leningrad. Most people don't know that Putin had an older brother. Now, his mother had to give the baby off to a hospice type place, which had some milk and had some provisions for little infants, because she didn't have any. Okay. She never saw the little boy again. Putin has said, you know, he's over there. We're almost 1 million people are buried in Leningrad. It's the most impressive monument you can imagine. So now, Putin's mother was given up for dead. She was put on a pile of bodies when, luckily, our father, a Navy, I mean, Putin's father, a Navy veteran who had been wounded defending a bridge there in Leningrad, came home and looked for her and found her on this heap of dead bodies. She was alive. And long story short, he rescued her, found some food to give her. She lived, and so they had this little boy named Vladimir Vladimirovich, okay? So what am I saying? I'm saying that's where Putin's coming from, as they say these days. That's where he's coming from, okay? He's not coming from privileged existence like Biden, or to an even greater extent, Blinken or Sullivan. He didn't go to any Ivy League colleges, and he didn't grow up thinking that he knew everything about everything. Okay. Now, given that background, I think it's all the more startling that Putin is as measured, as circumspect, and as principled and statesman-like as he is. And you can quote me on that. I think we're the beneficiary of that. I was surprised that he went into Ukraine, but that was because I didn't know the half of it. I didn't know about the uptick in Ukrainian government shelling of Donetsk and Luhansk, 500 shellings on the 14th of February 2022, 4,000 shellings just 3 days later. And the most important thing I didn't know, even though I should have, since my whole portfolio included relations between Russia and China, I didn't know that Xi Jinping would support Putin's invasion of Ukraine. Now, I confess that I'm not a Chinese scholar. I mean, a scholar of Chinese affairs, but I did seek really good advice from people I trust and who do know a lot about China. And all of them, to a person, said, Ray, China has this principle of Westphalia, 1648, end of the 30 Years' War. No violation of these boundaries of states, no intervention in the affairs of other countries. That's a bedrock principle. They would never approve of Putin going to Ukraine. Well, guess what? When Putin went up there to Beijing to launch the Winter Olympics again, this time in Beijing, he had a long talk with Xi Jinping. And I don't know exactly, I wasn't a fly on the wall, but I think given what we know happened after that, and he said to Xi Jinping, look, we've been diddled by the West in the Minsk Accords. They've upticked the shelling by several degrees in Donbass. There are Nazis all over the Ukraine government. We're going to have to go in to Ukraine. And so my notion is that's what Putin told Xi Jinping. And then he said, well, what do you think? And Xi Jinping said, you mean after the Olympics are over, right? Westphalia, we'll carve out an exception for you on Westphalia. We won't even criticize what you do. We'll say each country has the right to pursue its own core interests, and we view things like the invasion of Ukraine on the merits of the particular situation. Did the Chinese say that? Yes, they did. Did they say that for several weeks and months thereafter? Yes, they did. Westphalia, they gave them an exemption, you know? So all I'm saying here is that is the new element here, and that Putin, I don't know if he would have done it anyway. A lot of people say, yeah, he would have done it. I don't know. But certainly, with China at your back, and it's proven to be so. I mean, it's illusory to say that we clever Americans are going to drive a wedge between China and Russia when we're openly avowing to defeat both of them in widely separated wars. So, you know, these clowns in Washington don't know their rear ends from their elbows. And it's increasingly apparent to both the Chinese and the Russians. And I think that they're playing a waiting game to see what happens in November, whether there's any hope that more enlightened leadership would come in. And I hope that hope they're right in having some hope, because I'm trying to gin up some hope myself.
China was calling NATO a walking war machine because of these problems they're having in the Asia-Pacific region. Is it going to get worse, in your opinion? Is it going to get better? What's your take on this?
Well, Nima, the U.S. Navy has always been paramount in East Asia as well as other waters. That's no longer the case. China has built up its navy and is able to defend itself in a way that China never, over five millennia, has been able to defend itself before. Rather than sort of get that new situation, the Navy obviously wants to match the Chinese in building more ships. We got to get more ships, you know, double the amount of ships that we have. And who profits from that? The military-industrial complex. Big deal, you know? And so here's Biden, or here's the people advising Biden and Trump before him, we got to take on China. Why? Well, here's Biden, 1 month after he came into office. Major speech. China has pretensions to become not only the largest economic, but the largest political and military power in the world. That's not going to happen on my watch. End quote. Well, my reaction to that was, why not? As long as they're not threatening anyone. I mean, why provoke them into developing still more weaponry? Why try to create a NATO/Pacific by enrolling the Japanese, who have historical problems with the Chinese, right? And other people in that part of the world. Why don't you just let things be, okay? The Chinese have a way of approaching it and say, look, can't we just get along? I mean, like, how about a win-win situation? But that's not part of the calculus. I mean, you can't have a peaceful situation and still build more and more ships and more and more. So why do ships go through the Taiwan Strait? Why do they go real close to the Chinese ports? Well, it's just to show that the Chinese are belligerent. If we said recently, about a month ago, we flew a bomber, a B-52. Those are bombers, okay? And it was really pretty close to the littoral there in China. And it was intercepted by a Chinese aircraft. And people say it came within 20 feet. I mean, it's hard to believe, but my God, there are photos of it. Now, what's that all about? Well, the Chinese are no longer playing second fiddle. I mean, they have a very powerful Navy and Air Force. And, you know, let's say the U.S. did protest. What are you doing flying so close to our bomber? And the Chinese said, well, what's your bomber doing flying so close to our coast? What if there's an incident? Suppose that somebody gets knocked down. Suppose it's going to, what are you going to do about it? So there's all kinds of interests in arming Taiwan. Again, a lot of people get really, but my prediction for Taiwan is that the Chinese are in no rush to have what most of the world recognizes, that Taiwan is part of China, and that the Taiwanese are, you know, it's going to, history will show that this will evolve without any attack by China. So making believe that China is a menace to Taiwan, is going to attack it, that just serves to build more ships, make more airplanes, and do more provocative things just to show that the Chinese are the ones that are being aggressive. There's one other aspect here that should be mentioned because it's never mentioned in the press, and that is North Korea. Now, again, in my view, North Korea has been provoked by a much more belligerent South Korean regime that has had things like nuclear submarines from the U.S. go into port, other things that are deliberately provocative. And the head of North Korea has said, look, this is not going to last very long. And, you know, we're not even, don't even have the idea that we can negotiate with you anymore. We're back to square one. And the South Koreans and the White House know that North Korea is in receipt of one of the most sophisticated Russian ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missile systems, that the Russians had. Now, we know that. The experts I trust have looked at it very closely. It's been tested twice. It needs more testing, but it can reach all manner of places in the United States, the whole continental United States, and it's equipped with decoys and MIRVs. You know, people don't remember what MIRVs are. Multiple independently targetable reentry systems, I guess. Okay. Now, that means that on this one, it's called Topol M in Russia. I can't pronounce the Chinese name of it. As long as it's tested, it needs further testing according to what experts say, but it could be used today, you know, with less reliance that it would hit the right target. So, what does that mean? That means that Putin surprises me again. I didn't think he'd give North Korea an ICBM of recent vintage, but he has. Take it to the bank, he has. Well, what does that mean? Well, that means not only China, but North Korea has a deterrent, okay? A deterrent against US action in that part of the world, okay? That's important. And that allows Putin and Xi to say, okay, North Korea, you're part of our alliance now. And, you know, to seal this, you have Putin going to North Korea this year. That hadn't happened in a really long time. Of course, they met there a year ago, but that was not an official kind of a state visit. So that's another aspect of all this stuff. And I think that when you talk about China, you have to realize that the Chinese, traditionally, and, you know, when I say traditionally, people say, oh, centuries. Well, it's not centuries, folks. It's millennia. Right? So they had this inward look where they have 1.4 billion people there now. And what has Xi Jinping been able to do with them? He's brought half of them out of poverty. I mean, that's a pretty good deal. And simultaneously, he's built up their cities and weaponry as well. So why don't we just get along and not think that we have to be number one in every way? Why does the president of the United States say, as he did 60 Minutes just 3 weeks ago, we're the United States of America, the most powerful country in the history of the world. In the history of the world, you get it? Well, hey, Mr. Biden, we ain't anymore. These acolyte advisors that he has, I don't know if they're too chicken or they don't realize it either, but we ain't anymore. And unless we realize that pretty damn soon, it's going to get worse instead of better.
How do you see the situation right now in Israel, in Red Sea?
I would say, first off, that the Houthis belong in that same disregarded category as those brown bear feet going through the jungles in Vietnam that could never defeat us. Or those people with the towels on their heads, so to speak, in Iraq. Or those people in Afghanistan who we would never lose to. The Houthis are regarded in that way, or have been. Even though they fought a 7-year war with Saudi Arabia, supported by the United States, and it ended in a draw, but the Houthis really won their objectives. Okay, so here's the Houthis. Do they have any alliances now? Oh, wow. Yes. Yesterday picked up a really big ally. And who is that? The International Court of Justice. God, you know, who would have thought that the aims of the Houthis would be exactly the same as the aims of the International Court of Justice? But they are. What are they? To stop the genocide. Very simple, okay? Now, the Houthis are patting themselves on the back. They said, you know, we're not going to give in to the United States. They're not going to invade Yemen. And we have all these various mobile systems that we can wreak havoc in the Red Sea. And finally, the Europeans and others are going to say, well, maybe there's a better way than this, okay? So the Houthis have the upper hand here. And what's their declared objective? To stop the genocide, to let aid in and to stop the genocide. Well, that's what the International Court of Justice said yesterday in no uncertain terms. So what happens now? Well, will the Houthis become a little bit more respectable in the world's eyes? Will the Arab regimes and Turkey and Iran think, well, this is a little embarrassing, have the little Houthis doing our work for us? Will they come to the fore and say, look, that's enough, no more genocide? I mean, it's going to be a month before Israel has to report back to the International Court of Justice. But what happened yesterday is really, really big. Meanwhile, there's a blockade in the Red Sea. Supplies are not getting through. They're having to go around the Horn of Africa in the reverse way from Vasco da Gama, if I remember correctly, okay, to get to Israel. And Israel is suffering economic problems because of that. In addition to that, I think that the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, and BDS sanctions, will grow in our country and other countries. And people will say, look, I mean, the International Court of Justice, including the lawyer judge that the Israelis nominated to sit on that court for this proceeding, they condemn this. It's genocide. I mean, they didn't say ceasefire. They said all the things that require a ceasefire, like stopping killing people, stopping maiming people, destroying neighborhoods, and stopping people from being born. What does that mean? Well, think about it. What happened to the maternity hospitals? What happened to the people who are giving birth now in Gaza? So I'm trying to get back to your original question here, but you know, this situation is going to resolve itself more quickly than we thought. The U.S. has not yet, to my knowledge, pronounced on whether they support Israeli defiance of this ruling by the International Court of Justice. Up until now, they've been saying, oh, it has no merit at all. Well, Nobody believes that. What will the U.S. decide to do now? That's the key, because as everybody should recognize, the genocide cannot happen without the full support of the United States regime. And I use that term advisedly because it's Biden and his acolytes. It's not the rest of us, okay? So will he come to his senses? Well, I'm not sure. But the die is cast now, within the next month for sure, we'll learn what will happen in Gaza. And I duly hope that there'll be enough pressure on the Israelis to have them stop killing people in Gaza. Got 12,000 already, young children. And you know, I'd like to finish with what Roger Waters said. We need to make it so that no one kills the children anymore.
Ray, when you look at Europe right now, with all the difficulties they're having with the inflation, they started talking about fighting Russia. What's the logic behind this? Are they really feeling some sort of threat coming from Russia, or they're just repeating the rhetoric coming from Washington?
It's a made-up threat. They didn't even perceive this threat. They didn't even have rhetoric about this threat until after the West overthrew the duly elected government in Kiev on the 22nd of February, 2014. Okay, before that, George W. Bush said the Russians and the Chinese are proceeding along their own paths. They're pretty much, we have to get along with them. There's no threat to us. George W. Bush, for God's sake. Okay, so what happened? There was this coup. It was the most blatant coup in the history, in human history. And we think we've talked about that before. And the Russians were left with, well, what do we do? Now, the first thing that the coup managers and the new administrators of Ukraine said, let's join NATO. Now, that had been a no-no since at least 2008, when William Burns, now the CIA director, but then the ambassador to Moscow, was told by Sergei Lavrov, do you know what net means, Mr. Burns? Net means net. Mm-hmm. NATO in Ukraine is our red. Ukraine and NATO is our red line. Burns played it straight then. That was the title he gave to the cable. We have the cable, thanks to WikiLeaks, okay? And, you know, it was really interesting because what Lavrov also said was, look, if Ukraine goes into NATO, there's going to be a civil war in Ukraine. And we will have to decide, we Russians, whether we need to intervene or not. So don't face us with that choice. Got it? Got it? Now, again, to his credit, Burns reported that actually back to Washington. But what is Burns saying now? That was February 2nd, 2008, okay? What's he saying now? Well, it's 2008. Let's see if I can do the math. 12 and 4, but that's 16 years ago, so, okay. Well, now he's saying, the Russians are completely unprovoked. Yeah, we wanted to get Ukraine and NATO. Yeah, they warned us about that. Yeah, the Secretary General of NATO has said publicly that the Russians says, if you let Ukraine and NATO, we're going to invade. And so, as Stoltenberg, Secretary General of NATO, has said, so Putin got enlargement of it. You got more. You got the Finland, you got Sweden. Instead of less, you got more. My God. He made it clear that the invasion could have been prevented if they simply said, okay, no Ukraine in NATO. So what I'm saying here is that it's very clear that 2014 was the liminal point, okay? Where was Putin? He was in Sochi, finishing up the Winter Olympics. Why was he in Sochi when YouTube had advertised this coup 2.5 weeks before, namely on the 4th of February, 2014? Because like me, he said, oh, that's embarrassing for the West. The coup is blown, in intelligence term, okay? Not going to be a coup anymore if it's in YouTube, forget that. So I'll stay in Sochi. I'll finish up the Olympics. Well, guess what? Putin and I were wrong. They had such chutzpah that they did the coup anyway, and they put the same people that was mentioned in YouTube into power. So Putin comes home, right? So now it's the 23rd of February 2014. And he says, what are we going to do? And they look around the table. He's got his military and his civilian advisors. Well, you know, Ukraine and NATO, that means no more major naval port in Sevastopol in Crimea. So at very least, I mean, hello, are we going to sort of acquiesce in NATO taking over our main naval? So Putin says, well, that's of course what, and the Crimeans, they're primarily Russian stock, right? Yeah, that's right. Well, how do they feel about it? They don't want to exist under the coup regime. So what are we going to do? Well, says Putin, wait a second. Crimea used to be part of Russia, for God's sake. What happened? So his Lavrov probably said, well, Mr. Putin, as you may recall, when Khrushchev came in 1954, right after Stalin died, he needed a lot of political support. And he had a lot of friends in Ukraine. Actually, he lived and born right on the border there with Ukraine. So he thought, well, let's kind of help curry favor with the Ukrainian politicians. And so he said, well, okay, from now on, Crimea will be part of Ukraine. And Putin says, well, how do you do that? Lavrov, I wasn't a fly on the wall, but I imagine Lavrov or somebody said, well, he took a piece of paper. This is the way we used to do things, remember? Took a piece of paper and he did an ukaz. That's an order. He said, from now on, Crimea will be part of Ukraine. And it happened, okay? Now, it didn't matter then, of course, because Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union, for God's sake. So, there. It matters now, Mr. Putin. What are we going to do? So Putin says, I don't like this. I don't like this ukaz business. If we think that the Crimeans really want to join Russia, let's have a plebiscite, which they did. Long story short, they voted to join Russia, and they were accepted, okay? And there was great rejoicing in Crimea to be part of Russia again. What else happened? Well, there were people of Russian stock in the Donbass, in the oblasts of Donetsk and Lugansk, okay? And they didn't want to live under the coup regime either, okay? And so they said, Mr. Putin, thanks for taking Crimea and now take us too. And he said, no, we're not going to do that. You work it out. So they worked out the Minsk Accords. The Minsk Accords were never enforced by Britain and France. By the UK, by Germany and France. And they felt, by the way, the Russians were diddled for 7 years while NATO built up Ukrainian forces. So that didn't work out. So what happened? Well, the West reacted bitterly to the accession of Crimea, and there were some Soviet special forces, no doubt, helping the dissidents in Donetsk and Lugansk. So the propaganda really started to rise, but it was all directed right at Ukraine. Nobody's talking about Western Europe, except Russophobes like, what's her name? Hill, Fiona Hill, who trained under Richard Pipes at Harvard, who is the arch Russophobe in all academia. Okay, and she said, what Putin wants to do is to kick us out of Europe, and he probably will say, and get out of here, and don't let the door hit your backside on the way out. Quotes, New York Times op-ed, about 2 years ago now, okay? So this concept that the Russians are going to go farther, okay, that it was never even in their rhetoric, it's still not in their rhetoric, but it wasn't in NATO or Western rhetoric, it's still now, till now. Why is it in there now? Because they need some reason to rally the people in the Baltics, the people in Germany who are pretty much susceptible to this kind of thing, the people who are uneducated because of the press, the mainstream press in Europe. Now, this is hard for anyone to understand. As bad as it is in the United States of America, it's worse still in Europe and worse still in the UK, okay? So people don't know about this. So when, now that if they want to get some more money for the Ukrainians, you got to have an enhanced threat. And you got to say, well, Putin's not going to stop in Ukraine. Well, there's no evidence at all that Putin wants to take the whole of Ukraine in the first place, but that he won't stop. And you go, what, is he going to go to Paris, or is he going to go to Berlin, or you know, the Baltic state, Poland? I don't think so. Why? Putin says, Putin, and Ansi says, why would I want to do that? I mean, you know, unless you want to really believe that I'm Hitler, why would I want to do that? Now, with respect to the Germans, I know a little bit about the Germans. I lived there for 5 years. I did a couple of tours there. And, you know, I hearken back to NATO's original purpose. The first Secretary General, Lord Ismay, declared the whole purpose of NATO is keep the U.S. in, keep the Russians out, and keep the Germans down. Down means divided, means demilitarized. Well, now, I'm a child of World War II and the Cold War. Well, I thought that was a good idea. And my two tours of Germany didn't change that point of view. They're wonderful people, incredibly intelligent and apt. But, you know, if I were Mr. Putin, when Secretary of State James Baker came over in February of 2000 and said, look, here's the deal. We'd like you to accept a reunited Germany. I mean, when I first heard that, I went, and I come from a country that has until now been protected by two huge oceans. Putin, Gorbachev in those days, comes from a country that lost 26 million plus in World War II, okay? So I can imagine if I went like this, Putin went the same. So what's the quo for this? What's the quo? That's a big quid. That's a tough quid to swallow. What's the quo? And the quo, of course, was, well, if you agree to a reunited Germany, we will promise not to move NATO one inch to the east of the East German border. Now, Gorbachev bought that. He didn't get it written down, okay? But that was the deal. It's clear in all kinds of documents, German foreign ministry documents, as well as U.S. documents and French documents. That was the deal. The U.S. reneged on that deal, and that's how it all started to go down. As the U.S. doubled NATO in size, I think it was 16 at the time of the deal, became 30. Now I think it's 32, for God's sake. I mean, and they're all, well, except maybe, I haven't checked the map here. Maybe Finland is, or maybe Sweden isn't to the east of East Germany, but all the others are. So, okay, so what am I saying here? Well, if you look at the Russians now, Gorbachev, a statesman, a reasonable person who trusted the West, died as an outcast. The Russians just didn't see the good in him, even though he gave them their freedom. They saw that he had let himself be deceived by the West. So Putin is not going to make that same mistake. Matter of fact, he too has a record of having been deceived by the West, and he's admitted it. He said, and I quote him, "I was too naive when they said that the Minsk Accords will work out a deal where there would be a regional autonomy of some sort for Donetsk and Lugansk." I said, okay, good, let's do that. The UN approved that unanimously in the Security Council. So, you know, this is a peaceful way to work out. What happens? The French and the Germans played Putin. During those 7 years, the Ukrainian army, which didn't amount to much right after the coup, became trained in NATO weapons, trained in NATO standards, and were built up to the point where they became one of the most powerful armies in Europe. And then, you know, pouring salt in the wounds, the two people responsible for this, most responsible, Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany at the time, and François Hollande, President of France, both admitted. Angela Merkel in December of 2022, Hollande a month or two later. What Merkel said was, this was just to buy some time so that we could build up the Ukrainian army. And look at them now. And Putin, Russia, I don't think could believe that these guys would admit and brag about how they deceived him. Last word here, when a president of a country says, you know, I was naive, I should have said to those people in Donetsk and Lugansk, okay, come on in. We'll accept you just like we accepted Crimea. And of course, the things worked out in such a way that they are now. So I made a mistake. Rest assured, I'm not going to make the same mistake again. So the Russians are not going to lose in Ukraine. The Europeans, as naive and ill-informed as they are, I don't think they're going to come up with enough money to keep the Ukrainian government afloat. And the relationship between Germany and Russia has been poisoned, deliberately. That's going to take many years for it to heal. And that, of course, is what the neocon advisors of Biden want. They saw the cheap Russian gas that Europe was getting and powering their industry and heating their homes and all that stuff was making Europe too dependent on this evil regime, right? And so they sabotage the pipelines. And now the Germans and French are paying 6 or 7 times as much to heat their homes. And there's lots of trouble, as you pointed out. Even the farmers, you know, they can't even get diesel stuff to power their tractors. So the farmers are up in arms, you know, with pitchforks. Well, who knows? I mean, it's going to be a tough winter and a tough spring. And my prediction is that the Scholz government in Berlin is not long for this world. It's going to be really interesting to watch German developments. And, you know, for the Russians to be looking at, you know, what Lord Ismay said way back in the late 1940s. Keep the Americans in, keep the Russians out, keep the Germans down, keep the Germans divided. Well, if I were a Russian, I'd say, you know, he was right the first time. And Gorbachev was really naive in trusting the West.